Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
Thanks again, Steve, for the welcome, and you all for having me again. I've known this congregation, as Steve said, for a while, and I feel like I come back to familiar faces every time I'm here. So it's nice to be back. As I've looked this week back on what I've said to you in the past, it's been about some difficult issues: white supremacy, marginalized motherhood, lots more. When I preached for you last summer, it was during a bloody season, the shooting at the Pulse nightclub. Remember that? The police murders of more black and brown young men across the country and here in the New York area. You remember that summer? It's not a good one. I did a lot of guest preaching that summer, and so I have a small catalog of angry, grieving sermons with acute criticism and prayers for hope and justice and transformation, all of which are still appropriate. They're probably some of my better sermons last summer also, but I didn't have the heart to just kind of revive and update one for us again this morning, which is one of the only perks of going to different congregations every Sunday morning. But I haven't just revived and updated one of those sermons because, right, since last summer, our lives have changed again. The election of a childish bigot in the White House has brought with it a rolling storm of violence and public hatred, sparks of major international strife, environmental devastation. There's been terrible storms. And if you're like me, a cracked and barren place where my hope used to grow. To be sure, there have been some bright spots, right? It hasn't all been awful. We've watched Confederate statues crumble as people reclaim their town squares, young lawyers at airports halting the immigration ban, hundreds of thousands of women and many others gathering in the streets to say, "We will fight back." In my life, people who have not been very political before are getting active with their communities. And as much as we like to cast that retrospective glow on Obama, we know that many movements have never had an ally in the White House, and they keep on keeping on as surely as they always have, right? We can look to them. So yes, there are bright spots. But what about these worn-out, hopeless places in our hearts? You feel it too, right? I'm not just talking about election, I'm talking about so many of the ways that we have asked for proof that the arc of the moral universe bends towards justice, and instead we've just gotten more heartbreak to throw on the pile. I've heard from so many people that since last November, our overwhelm feels different now than in the many bloody seasons that have come before. What do we do with that sad, frustrated, or helpless feeling? Many of us are tired and worried. It's going to be a long 3 years before substantive change comes to DC, if it does. Who will be a reasonable presence? Will we even forget what reasonable is? Who will prevent nuclear war? Who will fund the EPA so future us has a shot at slowing climate change and preventing these storms? Who will bring together these small grassroots movements? Who will fund them? Who will tell the new Nazis no when Black Lives Matter has just begun to show us that white supremacy is the air that we breathe? Maybe all of this good work to do feels like arms pulling us in 100 directions. We're stretched thin. Maybe we have never quite trusted our own power to effect enough change in the first place. Regardless, the daily news bombardment is enough to keep any reasonable person afraid and upset, right? Where does hope grow in times like these? When despair for the world grows in me, writes poet Wendell Berry, and I wake in the night at the least sound in fear of what my life and my children's life may be, I go and lie down, he says, where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water. I've always loved this poem, but to be honest, I've struggled with it, too. A slightly different me would love to write, when despair for the world grows in me, I go and find a protest, and I yell super loud, and I call my senators, and I find local partners in directly affected communities, and we work really, really hard in fear of what our life and our children's life may be. Right? We know that these movements are urgent, and that people are dying on the border and in the streets and in Syria and in Houston. Who has the luxury of going to lie down anywhere? What kind of abuse of privilege is that? And also, we know that rest is important, that Sabbath is important. So many of the world's great religious traditions find a deep usefulness in stepping away, at least for a little while, taking a break. The Jewish Shabbat is perhaps the most recognizable and institutionalized. Muslims also kneel and rest their heads on the ground 5 times a day. Buddhists and others who practice meditative prayer know the value of being quiet, stopping to take stock of one's place in the world. So with that in mind, and on the advice of good mentors, I've, the past couple of years, managed to keep a Sabbath practice going during seminary. I take an entire day off of schoolwork once a week. I avoid all my school friends and the buildings themselves, and I take a long walk exploring different parts of New York City where I live. It means that I work 12 to 14 hours each of the other 6 days, but there is always that one day where I get to be a multifaceted person who is rested, who goes to museums, who reads novels in cafes, who knows the quiet corners of Central Park where the great herons might go feed. I wrote this a few years ago about Sabbath. My Sabbath adventures have taught me what it is to be enough. If I do not finish all of my readings because I'm taking a day off to let all of the other readings sink in, I know that I'm doing the best I can. This semester, I have been asked to trust that my best is enough. And it has been. I am more than the work that I do. In a culture that tells me otherwise, my claim of sufficiency is an act of resistance and liberation. But I have to tell you, in recent semesters, I've begun a slippery slope excuse policy where it comes to my Sabbath. I've been using it as a day off to sort of catch up on all my other work, right? Running errands, writing email, reading the news. And I'll tell you this, it doesn't feel like an act of resistance or liberation much anymore. I'm recommitting, then, to my Sabbath of practice, so my practice of Sabbath as a rest for mind, body, and spirit. And I'm going to listen to the celebrated Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. Heschel, in a book called Sabbath, writes, "He who wants to enter the holiness of the day must first lay down the profanity of being yoked to toil. He must go away from the screech of dissonant days. He must say farewell to manual work and learn to understand that the world has already been created and will survive without the help of man. 6 days a week we wrestle with the world. On the Sabbath, we especially care for the seed of eternity planted in the soul. Man is not a beast of burden, and the Sabbath is not for the purpose of enhancing the efficiency of his work. It is not an interlude, but the climax of living." That's what Heschel says. And Heschel was not a shirker from the world. Most of his family died in the Holocaust in Europe. Later in his life, he marched arm in arm with Dr. King throughout the civil rights movement. Yet here he offers us a perspective on the world grounded in wholeness and enoughness. In the face of the evils of his world and ours, Heschel calls us to observe the Sabbath as a sanctuary in time, an opportunity for the body, mind, and soul to catch up with each other and to unite together with what is holy. The world and we are never too broken to be barred from that holiness. In fact, it is our celebration of Sabbath that we remember precisely that, that everyone has a right to rest. Maybe just enough Sabbath is not an abuse of privilege then. Maybe it is, in fact, a reminder that all are dignified and whole, that there are seeds of eternity planted in our soul. Perhaps Heschel would argue that that is where hope grows. The radical rules of Sabbath are on purpose. For one, don't work. Though it's not simply about not working, even if Heschel's conservative Judaism rules about not spending any money, not pressing any buttons, not driving cars might not be feasible for us, maybe our Sabbath might look like abstaining from social media or the news, traveling by foot, spending time with people that we love, feeding our passions, allowing space for our joy and creativity to emerge. Perhaps for you it means coming here to rest for a moment on the forming edge of our lives and look into one another's faces. Some people already have a skeleton Sabbath built in on the weekend. And how fitting on this Labor Day Sunday, right, to offer our gratitude for the weekend, which was founded on religious ideas of Sabbath and gradually incorporated into American public life, starting in the 1920s. The labor movement started Labor Day, a day of rest, to honor days of work and the workers who struggled through them. The labor movement believed in Heschel's sense of the dignity of all human beings. Solidarity is the key principle of their movement, that each must care for all. Perhaps in this we can glean another principle of observing the Sabbath. If it indeed is a climax of living, there must be time that is not the climax. We distinguish rest because we also work. Sabbath is not about lying down in the woods to run away from the problems of the world. It is about bringing to the world, to ourselves as part of the world, a measure of peace and joy. If we are overwhelmed by the suffering and the worries of our people, perhaps the response is, sometimes as best we are able, not to add more suffering and worry to the pile. We cannot offer to the world what we do not have to give. That's the recipe for burnout, quick and easy. Some of us know that well. Our seventh principle says that we are intrinsically, inseparably part of the world. We are part of the problems and part of the solutions, for better or worse. And our own lives are where we have the most opportunity to affect the change we wish to see. So if we wish to see beauty, forgiveness, patience, and peace, may we find a way to foster those in our own hearts. What kind of flower does Heschel's seed of eternity offer if we plant it in our lives? I've been a Unitarian Universalist long enough to know that it's probably different for all of us. May we find enough time to water that seed in a dry, hopeless field in our hearts, and see what happens. No, it seems like there may have been never a better time to go for a moment and find a place where the wood drake rests on the water and the great herons feed. Or maybe wood drakes and herons aren't your thing. That's okay. We've changed up the order of service just a little bit this morning to offer you the special music now, after wading through some of these Sabbath ideas. We invite you to offer something during the offertory, and after you do so, to take a break, to listen to the music, to listen to your breath and your body, to take a moment and notice the forming edge of our lives. You're free to do or think whatever you need to, but try not to think so hard about anything that feels like work. Have a rest if you feel like. When we stop seeing ourselves by what we can produce, how hard we can work, and what needs to happen next, and start seeing ourselves as anxious, loving, interdependent parts of our bruised and loving world, the Sabbath becomes a celebration of the holiness within and around us. It, in itself, is an act of resistance and liberation, the watering of seeds of hope in a dry place. Blessed are you. Blessed is our world, and blessed be your rest.